I've been reading that true crime book that I got.
Which one?
The one about the Golden State Killer.
Oh, Michelle McNamara's book? It's a good one. That's a very good book. All you listeners out there in listener land.
Oh, we're recording now?
Michelle McNamara's...
Was.
I was going to say Michelle McNamara's book.
Oh.
is a very good source of information.
I got the updated one that has the how they added information about the catching of them.
Yes. Spoiler alert, they caught him.
Yeah.
After many, many decades. The most terrifying podcast I've ever listened to was a 5-part series on the history of the Golden State Killer. And it actually kept me up at night because it was so like detailed. And you're like, oh, he just was kind of just in your bedroom the whole time, wasn't he? Pretty freaky stuff.
I think it was a Criminal Minds episode, 2-parter based on him.
He would put plates and bowls on the guys' backs so they couldn't move. Because if he heard the plates jingle, he'd know the guys had moved. It was creepy. It was creepy stuff.
The original Night Stalker.
Yep. Eurons, they call him. East Area Rapist, Original Night Stalker.
One of his acronyms is EAR, and that just...
Yeah, it takes away a little bit. I'm glad that she created the Golden State Killer name. It makes a lot more sense.
GSK.
There was also the Ransacker. They found that he was also that Ransacker. And it's interesting that there was like... It's like 3 separate criminals that were then like, oh, it's all the same guy. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to in the 1980s, they were... 3 separate animes that were brought to America, and they were made into Robotech. One story. So it's kind of the same thing.
It's definitely not the same thing. This is not what we're supposed to be talking about.
It's just like Robotech. He's the Robotech of serial killers. Except Robotech's better at being an anime.
Now somebody's going to go out there and make an anime about the Golden State Killer. What have you done?
I thought you said now someone's going to go out there and become an anime-themed serial killer.
I think there already is one of those.
What is it called?
Robotech.
Digimon. Digimonster. I think Digimon just means digital monster.
It does.
He can just call himself the digital monster and let the police figure out that he's trying to be anime themed. Hey everyone, I'm Phil.
And I'm Molly.
And it's Del Toro time. It's Del Toro time. We are back with our review of the anime monster.
What movie are we watching? The Innocents?
The Innocents. 1961s, I think. I have the information right in front of me. I don't know why I'm sitting here like trying to guess at the information. 1961. It feels like the last like 22 movies we've done have been from 1961.
They definitely haven't.
It's just been a heck of a year for film. As we said last episode, I am not going to say much about the movie before we watch it because there's like little surprises along the way and I just don't want to give anything away. Let's just have it be known that this is a movie directed by Jack Clayton, who you probably never heard of.
Yeah, no.
Most people haven't. He's one of those directors that is like really respected by a lot of other directors, but who's not like a household name. He's more famous for the movies. Almost he's famous for this movie. He made also the movie Something Wicked This Way Comes, which was like a kind of a big deal.
Is that a play on Something Wicked Comes This Way?
No, it's based on the novel Something Wicked This Way Comes, which is...
No, I mean the word order.
No, Something Wicked This Way Comes is the word order, which is a quote from Macbeth.
So Something Wicked Comes This Way is a play on that?
Yes.
Okay.
By the pricking of my thumbs, Something Wicked This Way Comes is from Macbeth. One of the witches says it.
I was going to make a joke, but I'm not going to.
We saw a Macbeth adaptation, by the way.
Yeah, we did.
Yep.
It was not a lot like Macbeth.
It had some of the plot. In any case, he's famous for this. He's famous for that. But he's also really famous for the movies he didn't make. He was an extremely choosy film director.
You mean Del Toro?
Well, it's one of the reasons I think a lot of directors like they get it. They're like, yeah, he picked and chose his projects very carefully. But he turned down movies that ended up becoming like Casualties of War, which ended up being a big anti-war film in the late 80s. He turned down an adaptation of The Bourne Identity, which could have been a big hit, wasn't made until years later. And most famously, he turned down a little movie that was to become a film called Alien, which ended up actually creating, making the careers of everyone else involved with it.
You know, I'm glad he turned that down.
Why?
Because I'm glad of the way it turned out.
Well, no, I'm very pleased with Alien. I think it's a fantastic film. But as far as like... He's very famous for having been like, nah, I'm not interested in doing that.
Weren't a lot of directors not interested in doing
that? Yeah, yeah. But he's one of the ones that really stands out because he could have done a good job with it. It could have... his career ended up kind of languishing, and he kept having projects canceled on him, and then he had a massive stroke, and then he never worked again.
Great.
So this is kind of like a bummer of an ending to his career, but he's much appreciated for the movies he did make, including this one, The Innocents, which is based on the play The Innocents, except that when he came time to adapt it, he didn't actually like the play very much. And so even though the screenplay was written by the play's author, he got Truman Capote to do a lot of rewrites on it and fix it up to fall more in line with how he saw the story.
To make it scarier?
Which will make sense once we see it.
Is it scary?
It's going to be so scary that you will maintain a constant high-pitched scream throughout the entire running time of the film. You will never stop screaming.
You'd be surprised at what I don't find scary.
You will inhale in the first few seconds, and then you will emit a 99-minute-long scream. And then the movie will end, and you'll stop, and you'll pass out from fear, from terror.
So I'm going to take that as a no, it's not that scary.
You will
scary.
Run down the road screaming, help me, I watched the scariest movie.
So I'll take it as a no, it's not that scary.
It's so scary. Is it a so scary film? I've seen this movie a long time ago. I'm not going to say whether it's scary or not. That'll like, because if I say no, it's not scary, then you'll be like, burr. And if I say yes, it is scary, you'll be like, let's see about that.
Isn't that what this whole podcast is?
I'll let you determine if it's scary. As we've discussed in the past, like horror doesn't necessarily mean you're scared. It doesn't mean that the viewer is frightened. It sometimes just means that it's a movie that deals with horrific concepts.
But that's like what the past all the movies have been.
Sometimes a good horror movie is one that you're like, that wasn't that scary. But then like at midnight, you're awake and you're like, now I'm scared.
But I like being scared.
Well, good.
While watching movies.
Good.
Because if I'm not.
What I should do before we watch another movie is hire some people to sneak into the house and jump out at you.
See, that wouldn't work because I don't have a flight response. I have a fight response. So we just end getting sued.
Oh, they'd be very, very burly. And they'd come out and be like, "Ruah!" And you'd punch them in the face. But then they'd be like, doesn't hurt.
And then I would call my mom to come pick me up because I'd be so mad.
And then we do an episode and you were like, that was a pretty scary movie.
No, I'd be like, this podcast is over.
And then you'd be like, where were you guys hiding? There's not a whole lot of places to hide in the den.
There are. Oh wait, I can't make that joke because you haven't seen that season of.
Anyway, 1961's *The Innocents*, starring Deborah Kerr, and that's *The Innocents*, not *The Innocents*. Like it's hard to enunciate *Innocents*. Like those who are innocent, *The Innocents*, not *The Innocents*. Not.
What's the difference?
there's like, look at that innocent person. Now there are two of them. They are two innocents. Not like...
You're not pronouncing that word correctly and it's upsetting me greatly.
How do you think it should be pronounced?
Innocent.
Innocent. But I don't want people to think I'm saying innocence, which is like the concept of innocence. Like, you're innocent. You are filled with innocence. So...
Look, there's two innocent people.
Right.
Is that what you're trying to say?
Right. These are two innocents. Innocents.
So, innocent.
Innocence, but not innocence. Not okay. My heart is
so it's
innocence.
It's not the one that ends with a C-E.
Right.
It's the one that ends with a T.
T. S. S. Yes. The innocence.
Innocence.
See you later.
I am capable of talking in this position.
Listeners at home, Ollie is prone. Like literally horizontal, like flat.
Yep.
On a bed.
Yep.
And I was like, "You're gonna need to sit up so you can record this episode of It's Del Toro Time." But you refuse. You haven't moved a muscle.
No. I like this. It's comfortable.
I don't understand how you function.
Does anyone? Do I function? The answer is no.
Well, I guess as long as you're not. Don't move too much. I guess you're going to be fine.
I wasn't planning on moving.
I can tell from the way you're completely just a pool float of a person just laying there.
I'm tired.
Well, you can be tired and sit up.
Yeah, but that's a lot of work.
Is it?
I was already laying. Why am I crying all of a sudden?
Are you crying?
Yeah, see, there's a tear.
Just like the boy in The Innocents.
Except for I'm not dead.
Yes. And you're not going to suddenly kiss your governess.
No. No, I had to think about that. I mean, it depends on the governess.
I guess that's true.
Like, I would make out with Clara Oswald as a governess.
But even if you were 10, it would be very different.
Well, yes, that is true.
I was thinking that Clara Oswald would do well in the lead in this movie. Like the actress.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a new version of this coming out next year. It's supposed to come out this year, but it got pushed back. Starring Finn Wolfhard.
Oh, great. He's a great actor. I'm just so tired of people over-sexualizing him already.
I didn't over-sexualize him.
I didn't say you did.
Plus, isn't he a little old for the role now? He's a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to play the little boy? I guess they're really going for, like, the older kids stuff.
I think it's probably because they couldn't have an actual 10-year-old making out with a woman. Although I still think it's inappropriate to have a teenager making out with a grown woman.
The little boy didn't make out with the woman. He just kissed her hard on the mouth. But that's not making out.
In the adaptation of the play that we saw, they did make out.
Yes, but that was like an adult playing a little boy. Hello. We watched The Innocents.
Yes, we did.
And we just watched The Innocents.
Yep.
Not like usual, where it's like 7 months later and we come
stumbling
back into our house and try to remember what a movie was about. This was The Innocents. And what was special about this was I was like, so my big thing was I wanted to wait. I didn't say anything about the movie because I wanted to see how long it took you to catch on what this movie is actually an adaptation of.
How long did it take me?
It was probably like five, well, not counting the long intro, which is just child singing a song, and then the credits. Like about like several minutes into the first scene, and you were like, wait a minute.
Well, no, because I think it was like, at the beginning of the first scene, I was like, wow, this is a lot like Turn of the Screw.
Yeah.
And you're like, uh-huh.
And then
I was like,
were...
this is the exact same conversation from Turn of the Screw.
Uh-huh. So, yeah. So, The Innocents is based on Henry James's novella, The Turn of the Screw.
Great story.
Well, it is. You may see this movie listed somewhere and not realize that you were in for like an adaptation of a classic novel, if you were unfamiliar with The Innocents. And I think there's only ever been one theatrical adaptation of Turn of the Screw that's actually called The Turn of the Screw. All the other versions have completely different names. Even the new one coming out is called The Turning.
Great.
And I wonder if it's because, like, The Turn of the Screw is a metaphor that's not even from the main body of the story. It's from, like, the framing device.
Mm-hmm.
And if you cut the framing device, you lose, like, the reference to The Turn of the Screw.
What did you say earlier after we finished watching it about the new one? And I said, oh, that one's going to have ghosts in it.
Oh, I don't know, because there's a couple of new ones.
Oh, that's right. The Haunting of Hill House
second season of The Haunting of Hill House is going to be called The Haunting of Bly Manor. And it's going to be based, I mean, I assume loosely based on this.
Oh, yeah.
Dark Shadows, the old gothic soap opera from the 1960s had a plot line that was also based on this. In fact, there have been many things loosely based on this.
It's not surprising. It's an interesting premise.
It's a very interesting premise. So for those of you who aren't familiar, first of all, I would say that if you haven't seen this movie yet, The Innocents from 1961, it's available on DVD and Blu-ray. You can go out and find a copy of it. It's not available. It's not even available for streaming, like on Amazon. Like, you can't buy it streaming anywhere right now. It's kind of in that transitional period between being unavailable and being available everywhere. But if you have not seen it yet, I highly recommend watching it before listening to us discuss it.
Yes, because you got to watch it first.
Yeah, and you got to watch it with kind of an open mind, like like without being influenced by a lot of opinions on it, because it's very much a story open to interpretation.
Yes.
In fact, some critics of this movie say that it leaned a little too heavily on open to interpretation, even heavier than the book did. So I don't know. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the story, we're going to spoil everything.
Mm-hmm.
This is the plot of The Turn of the Screw, more or less, and this movie. The movie adheres pretty faithfully to the novel, novella. It's not a very long book. Henry James published it originally in like as a serialized story over several months. So it kind of had a lot of little cliffhangery things. And then, he rewrote it a little bit before final publication, but it's essentially always been the same story. And why don't we, I guess, just say what the story is about.
All right. So there's a governess.
Mm-hmm. Played by Deborah Kerr.
Mm-hmm. She's a bit too old for the role. But, you know, it's fine. The governess is like 20.
Yeah.
She's young. It's her first job. She gets hired by this uncle who is neglectful of these two kids that are under his care. He's like, yo, don't bother me.
Like, literally never bother me.
Yeah, like, don't ever contact me about these kids. They're your problem.
Right. He does not live in the same house as them.
And she's like, cool, whatever. And she's like, and then he's like, oh, wait, but don't forget this other governess died on the property.
Yeah.
And she's like, okay. And so she goes and she meets these kids. She meets this little girl. She's like, oh, I love this child.
Mm-hmm.
And she meets the housekeeper, Miss Gross. And she's like, oh, I love this housekeeper. And it's all dandy. And then a couple days later, they get a letter from the boys' school. And it says that he's been expelled and that he's going to come back. And she's like, oh, okay. That's a bit weird.
Yeah.
And they're both, and the housekeeper's like, expelled for what?
And no one says.
Yeah. So the boy comes back. Everything is happy and dandy and everything's great. She's a bit weirded out by the boy because he's a bit weird.
Yeah. He's an intense child.
Yes. And so she's like, okay.
We should point out that he's like 10 years old.
Yeah. The little girl's like 7 or 8, like Mitzi's age.
Yeah, yeah. They're close in age, but she is slightly younger.
Should probably also say their names.
Okay, so yeah. So the governess is Miss Giddens. And the children are Flora is the little girl and mm-hmm. Miles is the little boy. Flora and Miles. And Flora is a genuinely likable little girl.
Mm-hmm.
She's sweet. She's funny. She's energetic. And Miles is odd.
Mm-hmm.
He's very precocious, I guess you could say.
He's too old.
Yes, he acts like a little man. He calls everyone my dear. Yeah.
A little man.
He's a little man. So she starts seeing odd things around the house.
Mm-hmm. She finds this music box when the kids are playing hide and seek. Then Miles starts choking.
Miles jumps on her back. You can tell that Miles is a little like over enthusiastic about her.
Mm-hmm.
And I just did the thing with my eyebrows. You couldn't see listeners. He's a little over enthusiastic about her being there. And he jumps on her back in the attic and like puts his arms around her neck too tight.
Mm-hmm.
And won't let go. And she's like, you're choking me. And it's one of those moments where like, it could just be he's like an incredibly like active, clingy child.
Mm-hmm.
Which
would make sense considering he has literally had no affection.
I was going to say, who's had no affection at all
mm-hmm.
In a long time. But it also comes across as a little sinister. But she kind of brushes it off.
Yeah.
But she finds the music box and
the picture of whatever his name is.
There's a guy. A picture of a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so then she goes to hide. So it's her turn to hide.
Yes.
And she goes to hide behind curtains, and that's when this happens.
There's a man.
Who?
The man.
A man.
In the window.
And it's scary. It literally was scary. It's a scary moment.
It wasn't necessarily that was what scared me. It was her reaction to it, because I didn't expect like a loud noise all of a sudden. I was like, what is happening? Because I also didn't see the man right away. Like, because it shows like the man's face, but it's really fast. Mm-hmm. And I like blinked right when it happened. And I was like, why is she screaming?
And then he gets really close to the window.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like glaring in at her with this hideous expression on his face.
Yeah. And previously she had supposedly seen him up on the tower.
Right.
Miles was feeding the birds.
Right. Miles feeds pigeons, doves, which are just pigeons. They're literally just pigeons. Just white
Excuse
pigeons.
Excuse me. Pigeons are called rock doves. So be quiet.
Pigeon.
Is that the French way of saying that?
It's my French way. So she had already seen this like sort of mysterious male adult figure, and mm-hmm. she's like, does anyone else live here? And the housekeeper, Miss Gross, is like, nope. But now she's seen this man.
Yeah.
And she freaks out because he's like glaring, but no one, when she turns back, he's gone. She goes outside to look for him. He's nowhere to be found.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like where we start learning about some secrets about the house.
Mm-hmm. This man was the valet?
Valet. I thought you said ballet. I was like, nope, he certainly wasn't a valet.
No, the valet.
Yes, his name was Peter Quint.
Yeah, and apparently he was a real
piece of work.
Yep.
Pizza work.
I was going to say something ruder, but okay.
Yes. But he also had a relationship with the former governess.
That relationship is very complicated and hard to explain.
According to Miss Gross, he and she had a extremely physical relationship. I can't remember how she phrased it. She said, like, they treated bedrooms like dark forests or something.
They treated empty rooms like dark forests.
Yeah, and which is, you know, basically they were having sex in the bedrooms.
Yeah, and also he, like, physically abused her.
Right, and he also hit her across the face and, yeah, like, knocked her down a lot.
And, like, they did all this stuff, like, in front of, like, they didn't care who saw.
Yes.
And, like, there's, like, we think the kids saw what happened.
Yeah, we know that Miss Gross would walk in on them in being intimate.
Mm-hmm.
And the governess, Miss Giddens, Deborah Kerr, asks her, did the kids ever see this? And she's like, I'm sure I don't know, but they were everywhere. And it's implied through... So there's this... We're led to wonder if there wasn't something... if there wasn't impropriety between Peter Quint and the little boy.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly between all four of them.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get back to, we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
So Deborah Kerr is convinced that she's seeing the ghosts of Peter, mm-hmm, Quint and the former governess.
And Miss Gross is like, ha ha, okay.
Oh, yeah, because we also saw, like, this woman walk by in the hallway really, yeah, quickly. There's, like, this quick shot of a woman just walking past the hallway.
I liked that part. That was,
that was
good.
Creepy as all get out. So this house is amazing too.
Although it could honestly have just been one of the maids.
It could have been one. There's these, you hear about the rest of the house staff, but you rarely, you only see the one other house member of the house once.
Mm-hmm.
And she has one line. Her name is Anna. And that's it. You hear about them, but that's it.
And there is actually also a man who lives on the property. It's the cook's husband.
Right. And there's a gardener.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we don't see them.
Mm-hmm.
But so she starts seeing that. She sees a mysterious woman way in the distance when she's out by the lake.
Yeah.
So there's this lake where, and that we find out that's where the former governess drowned.
Herself.
Yeah. So the former governess, so Peter Quint died one night mysteriously.
He was drunk. No, he wasn't mysterious. He was drunk. He's coming back to the house. He slipped and he cracked his head open.
Right. And the little boy... Miles found him,
yeah,
and was wailing when they found him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the governess was distraught. At first, we're told she has wasted away and died, but then we find out that she had actually killed herself in the lake.
Mm-hmm. Why are you making quotation marks?
Well, you know, well,
it was... for some reason, you're convinced that the children killed them.
I just think there's open possibilities. Okay, so in any case... they don't ever say it, but you brought up the fact that it seems like the little girl, Flora, may have found, mm-hmm, the governess.
Yeah.
But we don't know. Like, mm-hmm, we don't know. Because people are very, very, very big on their secrets,
mm-hmm,
in the old house. So life goes on.
The governess gets more and more paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
She's convinced that the children are plotting against her.
Yes. She starts seeing the ghosts everywhere, and she becomes... She starts becoming convinced after Miles has a pretend birthday party,
mm-hmm,
and recites an amazingly creepy poem.
A really good poem.
Though. Really well. Really good recital. She starts becoming convinced that the ghosts of the former governess and the former valet are trying to possess the children.
And that's even more creepy when you, like, hear what she actually says. Like, because she goes, the ghosts want to be together, and the only way they can continue their physical relationship is through the children.
And right. They never come right out and say it, but there's a lot of stuff about, like, them corrupting the children, them, mm-hmm, being a corrupting presence. And the movie doesn't make any bones about what it's implying. Like, it's very much just, like, we know what she's saying.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, she starts becoming more and more convinced this is what's happening, and she begins... seemingly convincing Miss Gross about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't really... Miss Gross is a great character because we don't really ever really know what's going on in her head. She's so used to, like, sort of agreeing with whatever anyone's saying and just keeping her mouth shut about
things.
Which is
part of her flaw.
Right. So life goes on. Miles has... an improper moment with her.
Mm-hmm.
He kisses her on the mouth for way too long.
Mm-hmm.
Way too long. Mm-hmm. Much longer than I was expecting. And So there's a certain sexual promiscuity about him in particular that is sort of a little clue or a little sign that something is very wrong. She is, of course, convinced that it's because he's possessed by the ghost of this.
Yeah. And we'll get more into that later.
Yes. So the kids keep like disappearing and running off, and they're hard to keep track of. And at one point, Flora disappears. And they find her at the lake.
We forgot. Oh, well, no, that was it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We find her at the lake. She's dancing to the music box.
Yeah.
She's like, woo, this is fun. I'm traumatized.
Yeah. She took her boat out there, a little sail, a little rowing boat.
And for some reason, the governess is like, who taught you how to row?
Right. So, and then the governess sees this ghostly woman across the lake again, and she's like, look, look, don't you see her? And Flora's like, I don't see anything. And she's like, you have to admit you see her, you have to say her name.
And then Flora has a mental breakdown.
Miss Gross comes up. Flora has a complete breakdown and just begins screaming and screaming and screaming and screaming nonstop all night. It's also very effective. Like, again, these kid actors are extraordinarily good at what they do.
Yeah.
Miles reveals that he has a bird with a broken neck hidden under his pillow.
He also reveals that he and Flora were planning the whole, because, like, he was like, I think you're getting bored and I wanted to try being a bad kid for once.
Yeah. And so he's like, no, everything we've been doing is kind of just us, like,
messing with you
because we're tired, we're bored, like they're bored. And she's like, no, they're possessed by the ghosts. So Flora gets taken away, and she refuses to speak to the governess ever again. The governess is like, she says to Mrs. Gross, you need to take the entire house staff, everyone away with you to the city, take her back to her uncle. I'm going to stay here with Miles. I'm going to basically exorcise the ghost from Miles.
And the housekeeper's like,
but the uncle specifically said, while the governess is there, while Deborah Kerr is there, she's in charge. So they do. They leave, and it's just her and Miles alone in this big house.
And Miles is like, so why are we here?
Yeah. And why are they there? She loses track of him again. Before everyone leaves, she sees the ghost of the woman, the governess, again, doing math, I guess, is the...
No, she's crying.
Oh, she was crying over math.
Yeah.
There was, like, big math problems on... It was in this little school room.
Same, though.
Miles comes back in. They have, like, this exchange between each other.
Which is weird.
It's a very, very vague exchange. The long and short of it, she's trying to get Miles to admit that he's been seeing the ghost of Peter Quint.
Yeah. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. You're insane.
Yes. And he has, also he has his sister's pet tortoise.
We think. I'm still convinced it's a different tortoise.
It's a little tortoise. It's like fits in your hand. But he gets mad at her and he throws the tortoise through the window.
We think.
And then he runs off into the yard and into this like area that's like surrounded by statues, and she sees the ghost of Peter Quint, and she tells the little boy, look, 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 it's Peter Quint. And he's like, I don't see anything. She's like, admit that it was Peter Quint. And he does, or he says it was Peter Quint, or it's Peter Quint. And then
he dies.
And then
the end.
And that's it. He dies. She wails for a while and holds him in her arms. And then it has this end, says the end. And there's a pair of very creepy praying hands. And then the screen goes black and you're left sitting alone wondering what the hell you just watched.
Yep.
Because, oh boy, is this an intense movie. I don't think we did justice to just how stressful this movie is. It's a very stressful film. So my first question is this scary?
I don't really know how to define scary anymore.
Yeah.
It's disturbing and upsetting.
Yeah, it's generally referred to as not a horror movie. It generally gets labeled as a psychological thriller.
I think that that's what it is labeled as.
But you don't want to just call it a psychological thriller because that makes it land firmly on one side of the
It's definitely horrific in some moments.
Yes, and the implications are particularly horrific.
Yeah.
So What makes The Turn of the Screw such a popular ghost story, Henry James wrote many, many ghost stories, and he loved writing ghost stories. He was fascinated by them. The Turn of the Screw is the only one of his ghost stories that's really seemingly deliberately ambiguous as to whether or not the ghosts actually exist. Even though in his day, like when he wrote it, that wasn't a thing. It was kind of a later thing where people were like, you know, they never actually say if the ghosts are real or not. And there's a lot of clues throughout the text that she actually is imagining all these ghosts, and that it's actually her. The governess is like just wild speculations and her own like mental breakdown that's fueling all the action in here.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, other people were like, you know, it sounds a lot like these kids may have suffered from abuse at the hands of these two dead like employees of the house, and that's what's causing them to misbehave. And then that just sort of like snowballed until we get to this movie, which is just explicitly like, are they real? Are they not? Was there abuse? Was there not? And I think that the movie does a really good job at like throwing it all at you and just waiting to see what sticks.
Yep.
Because the kid's behavior, particularly the little boy, let's walk through it.
Okay.
So
let's start at the beginning.
Yes.
We know he was expelled from school.
Yes. Well, I was going to say, we know that she, Deborah Kerr, we know that she comes from a very conservative background.
Yes.
Her father was a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
She never got out much.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in this movie, she's 40 and this is her first job. Like,
I think she's not meant to be actually 40.
But I don't think she's meant to be 20. Like, okay. They don't doll her up. They don't make her look like a younger woman. Like, try to do that thing we saw in, like, what was that Hitchcock film where they're supposed to be, like, a teenage daughter, but she's actually played by, like, a 25-year-old woman. It's not that. It just, they kind of leave it open.
Mm-hmm.
But you still get the feeling that she's from a repressed background. She's nice, and
mm-hmm.
she's, like, funny and fun, but... Yeah, she's got her own issues.
Mm-hmm.
But then, so he gets expelled.
For being a disturbance, is a disturbance in the force. is pretty much all the letter said.
Yeah, for being like, she confronts him about it later on. She confronts Miles,
mm-hmm.
and he says that he was saying things,
mm-hmm.
and he makes these vague references to things in the house,
mm-hmm.
And sounds at night. And the implication seems to be that he was telling kids about what went on in the house,
mm-hmm.
and that it was upsetting them.
Yeah.
At least that's what I got from it.
And instead of helping him, they were like, you know what would be great? We'll send you back.
Well, this is the 1840s for you. So I guess this is set in the 19th century. This is like firmly in the 1840s. There's big hoop skirts. There's horse and carriages. There's a lot of mud. So 1840s.
Yes.
England. And... Yeah, so the implication is that he may have been saying sexually graphic things to the boys, maybe even doing things,
mm-hmm.
or trying to do things with the boys. And here's where I want to like just say to the audience, you know, like there's going to be some talk about child sexual abuse, because
mm-hmm.
that's a heavy implication in this movie.
Yeah.
Particularly with how promiscuous his actions are, and
mm-hmm.
I mean promiscuous in the sense that when a child acts out very sexually, that tends to be a sign that some sort of sexual abuse happened in their childhood, like in
mm-hmm.
like in their young childhood, because he's like 10, and it's that whole like the way he is with Deborah Kerr is very like
mm-hmm.
strangely inappropriate.
Yeah. And even a little towards his sister.
Yeah. But then again, you notice that kind of stuff because the seed is planted in your mind about that kind of
mm-hmm.
stuff. If you didn't know that, you might just think he's just an energetic kind of hanger on, like maybe a very touchy kid who you, like you said, was just starved for affection.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, it could be both though as well.
It could very well be both.
Because if like, it's all very complicated.
Yes. The other thing that's very ambiguous in this movie is what may or may not have happened to the children, because it cleverly does a lot of stuff. There's a lot of like visions and like
mm-hmm.
psychedelic sequences where it's all going on in Deborah Kerr's head. But in those visions, you get hints of like, you see a shot of like the groundskeeper, the valet, Peter Quint, leading the boy by the shoulder into a dark room, and mm-hmm. there's the former governess and the little girl are in there, and the mm-hmm. implication seems, because he's like very like handsy with the boy, mm-hmm. the implication seems, oh, you see a lot of shots of like older adult hands holding little kid hands,
mm-hmm.
and the implication seems to be that there was sexual impropriety going on with these children. But what are you gonna say?
There's also in the background of one of those scenes you can hear a woman saying, the kids can see us.
Yes.
And then a lot of noises.
Mm-hmm. And, but when you stop and think about it, all of that is still in Deborah Kerr's head. Mm-hmm. Like, she heard a few anecdotes from the maid, and then she started building up these visions on her own.
Again, which is why I want a movie from the point of view of the kids.
Right. It's, but it's also very much, it's also very much, is it her mind, or is that like part of the haunting of the house? It's showing her these things because she has nightmares, she has trouble sleeping, or is that just who she is? Like, it's very weird. Like, you gotta remember, this is, they're out in the country. These kids have no one to play with. They don't ever see any other children. They never see any adults other than the help. They're just completely isolated and kind of going a little nuts themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Like, is it all Deborah Kerr?
I don't think so.
No one else sees these ghosts.
Well, I don't think anyone else would see the ghosts. I don't think the ghosts are real.
One of the brilliant things about this script is that when she asks people if they see the ghosts, they're always a little shifty and cagey, but you don't know if it's because they're lying about seeing the ghosts or if it's because they're really just, they're trying to tell her what they think will calm her down, or like, it's kind of a really well-made movie.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this has all the elements of good psychological, like, what is happening? Because the script is very tight. The story is very, it stays firmly within her POV.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so in her head that even though it's a movie, and she doesn't narrate it, she still becomes the unreliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, are you really seeing all this?
I mean, I think she is really seeing all it.
Yes. Oh, so this was based on the play that was based on the novel. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the director hated the play because the play apparently comes right down on the side of, no, these are real ghosts. These are all real ghosts. This all really happened. It's left completely clear that this is an actual haunting and she mm-hmm. has to exorcise these spirits. And the director was like, no. No, I let's go back to the book. So he brought in Truman Capote to do a hard rewrite. And apparently it's been said that 90% of the dialogue in this movie, 90% of the scenario and the dialogue is Truman Capote's. Truman Capote is, he played up a lot of the psychosexual stuff, mm-hmm. and he played up, you pointed this out, the dying flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the dying flowers.
When she first walks into the house, she brushes against some roses and a bunch of petals fall off. And you see these roses throughout the entirety of the movie, and every time she brushes past one of them, the petals fall off.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen anytime anyone else passes them. Yeah. Just when she touches them.
Yeah, it's done really well too. Like, if you didn't notice it, you wouldn't notice it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wouldn't affect anything, but it's this wonderful touch, and that element of it is very Truman Capote Southern Gothic. He infused this with a lot of Southern Gothic, which is like the
country Gothic,
which is the psychosexual stuff, which is the decay, mm-hmm. the flora, as it were, in the house, dying around everyone to indicate like this, the rot inside the house.
Yeah. It's funny because I was in the writer's room when they were doing the Gothic literature unit for 10th grade, I think it was. Or was it 11th? I can't remember. But and they came in and they were talking about all of the like themes of Gothic horror, and decay was a big one. Mm-hmm. Like the idea of a house falling apart around you, or like the garden dying, and like, yeah, stuff like that. It's always been really fascinating.
Yeah, and from Fall of the House of Usher to what's the one where the house burns down at the end, and is it Jane Eyre?
No. Yes. No. Yes.
Wait. No, not Jane Eyre. It's the other one. Last night I dreamt I went to Mandalay again.
Right.
That's Rebecca.
Yes.
Was that Rebecca?
Yes.
I'm getting all. Well, yeah, that's a big thing. Like the collapse, the physical collapse around you. And Southern Gothic does a lot of that and takes it like sort of cranks it up to the like.
This movie is definitely gothic. Isolation, the decay, mm-hmm.
The woman alone in the house.
Is it real? Is it not? Like
the distant, the aloof man who, mm-hmm. I mean, he never comes back, but.
No, I think in the adaptation we watched, he does come back though.
And what's interesting is, so we've watched Jane Eyre, all these movies. We watched all these gothic thrillers, and it feels like this one is kind of
the gothic romances, but okay,
the culmination of all that, mm-hmm. like perfected, like going back to the original novel, of course, which is like almost perfect. This is kind of like, here's thanks for trying, everyone, but here it is at its most basic and psychological, and without all the frills and the frou-frou and the I accidentally killed my wife but I hid her body kind of stuff, or like I shut my ex up in the attic, like none of that stuff. This is just like, it's a woman, two kids, creepy house, are there ghosts?
Yeah. And like the idea, like another thing from gothic literature is the idea of falling into insanity.
Yes.
Which was really well done in this, not just for the governess, but for the kids as well.
Yeah.
Like you see Flora, who starts out as this like energetic, sweet little girl, like wear down.
Mm-hmm.
Like she becomes like tired, and then she just breaks.
Yeah.
And the boy, he like starts out like pretty chill in a weird way, but he slowly gets more and more like riled up because he doesn't know what's going on, and you see these like people like break.
Yeah.
Including the housekeeper as well. Like she's like, I can't say no to these people.
Right.
But I don't know what to do.
Yeah, even though both the kids have their breaking points, you know, Flora when she just finally just has a complete collapse, and Miles when he throws the turtle, you get to watch the kids, and this is, I think, what's so great about their performances and the direction is that even though they're breaking down as well, they're doing their best to hold it together.
Mm-hmm.
So they just get more manic, like, and trying to be happy and have a good time as things are collapsing around them. And it's so effective that when they do snap, it makes it more believable, mm-hmm. than if you just saw them like these kids just constantly falling apart.
Yeah. Like it's, you see it all the time in actual kids too. Like they get tired, they get
mm-hmm.
like overworked, or they have too much going on in one day. You see them get more and more hyped up.
Right. We also, so, speaking of ghosts, are they real or not? There's a quote in the movie where Deborah Kerr has seen the ghost again, and she's asking the maid, like she's asking Mrs. Gross, like I know Flora saw it, and Mrs. Gross is like, I know that she saw, and Deborah Kerr is like, what, and she's like, a memory. And or like had to face a memory.
Yeah.
Like it's all about the ghosts. The ghosts are very real to Deborah Kerr. They're very real to Mrs. Gross, too, but in the sense of there are things haunting this house, but it's the ghosts of what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, does that really matter which it is? Because they both seem to be having the same, like, horrible...
Oh, yeah. If you don't, like, deal with your problems, if you're just forced to nest in the place where they began... it will gnaw away at you.
Yeah.
Like, this little girl does her best to be happy, but she's left alone with a bunch of adults in this house where she witnessed these horrible things.
Yes.
Like, yes, ghosts are real, but not in the way that Deborah thinks they are.
Oh, God, what was I going to say? I totally went blank. You said Deborah, and it started made me think of Barbara, which made me think of Barbara Barbara doll, and then it made me think of that creepy doll that Flora has. Flora has this horrible doll. Oh, there's also, there's, man, there's so much to talk about this movie. There's all this pagan imagery in it, too. Their garden has all these statues. And there's this one scene that freaked me out where
Oh, the baby.
Deborah Kerr is just sort of exploring the garden, and she looks through, she pulls aside a couple of bushes, and there's this horrifying statue.
She's looking to find where the source of the singing is.
Oh, right, all right. She hears, yeah, oh my God, there's also this lullaby that keeps getting sung. She looks through these bushes, and there's a statue of
a baby
doing, it's holding hands, but the hands are missing.
His mouth is gaped open.
Well, the baby's mouth is gaped open, and it's apparently used to be holding someone's hands, but now it's just holding someone's hands. Like, the hands have been disconnected from whatever it used to hold. So it's a baby holding a pair of hands, its mouth is gaping open, and then hard close-up on the baby, and
the cockroach comes out of its mouth.
Out of its mouth. I couldn't tell if it was a roach or a cricket. It may have been a giant cricket.
Either way, it doesn't really matter at that point.
A bug crawls out of a baby mouth, and it's just, like, right there on the screen.
And it at first it looks like the baby is the one making the singing.
Yes. It's an incredibly upsetting moment in an already upsetting movie. And that's part of the gothic, like, imagery, is all these old statues. But also, there's, like, statues of, like, satyrs and, like, Roman, like, in...
Yeah, which I was like, is Medusa part of this household? Because
and,
what?
Well, and there's also like there's a ring of statues that look very much like a henge, like a stone circle that you would see like on
they're
the
all
hills
weeping
in
angels.
And it's unnerving, and it reminds me a lot of like the Don't Be Afraid of the Dark type dealings with like otherworldly stuff. I was like, when we were going through that whole period where we kept talking about like Arthur Macon and Algernon Blackwood, and there is something very much that creepy in that. It's like, even out of the house, it's not safe. The grounds are supernaturally charged in a way, and you keep seeing the image of the governess's quote unquote ghost across the lake is considered one of the scariest moments in film history. Like, it always pops up on like lists of like just scary moments in films. It's always like, that's, and it is very unnerving because it's, she's just far enough off that you can't make out her facial features that well. Like, you can tell it's a woman and kind of what she looks like, but she's just not in focus enough. And it's, I don't know, it's, it works. It's very effective. But yeah, like, there's this, the whole movie is just one big mystery. Like, and I kind of like that it's a mystery. One of the criticisms about the criticisms of the novel is that one of the critics said, like, Turn of the Screw isn't a puzzle to solve. Like, the joy of it lies in the fact that it's just perfectly ambiguous. Like,
maybe it's my experience with playing like survival horror games. But I always like finding story, like, story items.
Uh-huh.
Like, I always like unraveling the story. That's the fun of it for me.
Yeah.
So, like, leaving it, like, I get the whole leaving it ambiguous at the end because, like, who knows? But, like, also, sometimes for me, just, this movie did it really well, but sometimes for me, movies like this just have, are really unsatisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, great, so nothing good ever happens, ever. Fantastic, I love it so much. Oh, the protagonist gets thrown into jail because who knows if the ghosts were real. That kind of stuff upsets me.
I think one of the reasons I found this movie satisfying, even though it's ambiguous, and even the ending is open, like, what happens to her afterwards? Like,
oh, yeah, she's no, got this one did it really well.
She demands everyone to leave the house, and then the boy dies. And, like, does she go to jail? We don't know. I think it's emotionally satisfying. Like, everyone was so committed, and the direction was so strong.
Mm-hmm.
That even though I wasn't sure actually what happened at the end, like, why'd the boy die? We don't really know. Because everyone was so just committed to what was going on, I felt satisfied with the film. Like, it ended where it needed to end.
You'll never be satisfied. God, I hope you're satisfied.
Great. Now we have to pay for the rights to that song.
Just cut it out.
So as you said, the cast is great. You were like talking all about like the people who played each other. Peter Quint, played by Peter Wingard, is going to come up in a future movie.
Oh yeah, Burn Witch Burn.
He's going to be in Burn Witch Burn. which I am looking forward to. And what else did we learn about Peter Wingard?
He was the inspiration for Austin Powers.
Oh, behave.
I've never seen it.
Oh, behave.
Never seen it.
My mojo, baby. Yeah.
This Groovy. Is making me really uncomfortable.
My wife. It's great.
I'm really uncomfortable. Is it a comedy?
Don't care.
Is it a comedy?
What?
The movie.
Austin Powers?
Yeah.
God, I hope so.
Cool. I'll never watch it ever. Fantastic.
Groovy, baby. Yeah. Oh, behave. That's Austin Powers' impression. He goes...
Okay, we get it. We get it. This is making me really uncomfortable.
He makes all these noises.
Why did you make a Shrek reference?
Don't care.
Why?
Same actor.
Oh, okay.
My wife. But, yes. What were they saying? Peter Wingard was the inspiration for Austin Powers. You're very right. So I can't wait to see more of him. Megs Jenkins, who played Mrs. Gross, as you said, was in... like everything.
It's a lot of stuff.
The two kids were just great. Everyone was so good in this. Oh, the woman who played Anna, Isla Cameron, who played the Anna who had like one line in the whole movie and died at the age of 50. She was an actress, a folk singer. She has like a complete discography.
Mm-hmm.
She died so young. Like, do you know what she died of?
No, I did. I don't. I do know that. Was it Deborah Kerr who died of Parkinson's? Yes.
Yes.
And then her husband died like 3 weeks later of cancer.
Yeah.
She died at like 86, I think, though. So.
Oh, she died of an accident in her home.
Yikes.
That's all it says. She recorded all these folk albums, but then after 1966, she stopped recording for some reason. And then she died in her home in 1980 in an accident at the age of 50.
Yikes.
Isla Cameron. Look her up. Look her up. She was in this movie. She had one line.
It was a good line, though. I don't remember what it was. But she did a good job.
Yeah, she was good. Deborah Kerr, of course, is the lead in this. And she, you mentioned King and I.
Mm-hmm.
But as well as like a billion other things.
Yeah.
and then Michael Redgrave. Played the uncle in the very beginning. And
he was also very good.
He's very well. Michael Redgrave is part of the Redgrave acting dynasty. He's just, you know, the Redgraves are one of those old acting families.
That's a thing.
Oh yeah, like you know, like there's a million. Barrymores. There's like Lionel Barrymore and John Barrymore and Drew Barrymore. Like.
Never heard of any of those people.
Famous actors tend to be related to people. That's how you...
Wow, really?
Well, that's how... tend to be related to other famous people. That's how you get a leg up in Hollywood. That's how you make it through the door. And you may not realize it until like you're like, oh, they're actually so-and-so's cousin? And you're like, oh, that's why they're famous. Like, but yeah, Michael Redgrave, his children were Vanessa Redgrave, Corin Redgrave, and Lynn Redgrave. His parents were Roy Redgrave and Margaret. The fact that all of his family members have their own Wikipedia pages is like just like, oh, yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's a dynasty. But it's a big deal that he was like in like this little like bit part in this movie, but he did such a great job selling it.
Mm-hmm. Everyone did just such a great job in this movie.
Yes. I mean, this movie, I was going to say you could talk about this movie forever. People have talked about this movie forever. It's been written about, it's been rewritten about, it's been analyzed.
I wonder if anyone else has anything to say about this movie.
I wonder if anyone else has anything to say about this movie. This is It's Del Toro Time, a Guillermo del Toro podcast. And Guillermo del Toro has talked about this movie. Boy, has he. This is, he considers it one of the best ghost stories ever made. It was, I wonder if you can tell what movie of his it was a direct inspiration for.
Was it Crimson Peak?
Yes. Maybe the gothic ghost story that he did.
I try not to think about Crimson Peak.
Yes, I know. But yes, it was a direct inspiration for Crimson Peak.
No, I was going to say something during the, while we were watching it. I was like, wow, this seems a lot like Crimson Peak.
He actually talked about The Innocents quite a bit when Crimson Peak came out.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever he would be interviewed, people would be like, so what are the inspirations of this movie? And The Innocents is always one of the top ones. He says, his quote from our man, Guillermo del Toro, Jack Clayton is a filmmaker I love. Whether he's doing genre or not, his camera style is very rich. His camera style on The Innocents contains some of my favorite shots of all time. including the shot where Deborah Kerr first enters the house. The camera follows her through the foyer and into a room. That shot lasts for about 3 or 4 minutes, and it becomes an overhead, a close-up, and a master shot, all without cuts. And the camera work in this movie is...
Oh, yeah, it's phenomenal.
Beautiful. This is a gorgeous film. There's a lot of... there's
was
a lot
it
of
black and white?
Yeah.
Right, okay. It's that was weird.
It uses a lot of deep focus shots where like everything is in crystal clear focus, no matter how far away the characters are. And that requires a god-awful amount of lighting. And the story is that Deborah Kerr used to wear sunglasses on the set because the lighting was so bright. I was actually reading about it, and there was a list of like movies that use the technique like very well, famously. And in the commentary on it, it said Steven Soderbergh, the director, was like, because of like the frenetic way movies are edited these days and the fact that there's so much coverage they need to get for every shot, it's a lost art. Nobody uses it anymore. And they're like, yeah, like this type of focus, because of the way we don't do movies like this anymore, sorry. And then there's like a list of movies that famously use it. And like they go right up to last year. Mm-hmm. It's just, I was like, I guess they do still use it because there they are, like from...
What was with the pose that you were doing while you were talking about that?
Oh, scratching my back.
It looked like you were like making fun of the guy.
Steven Soderbergh. I mean, Steven Soderbergh's an artist and he's opinionated, but he makes very interesting movies.
You mean me? Except for the movies part.
You could make very interesting movies and you would say, come see my movies.
I would say, no one should watch this because I can't make movies.
Everybody's got to start somewhere.
See, my aspiration is to write a novel and then have that adapted into a Netflix show.
That's the secret.
Mm-hmm.
Do it.
Hey, if Gerard Way can do it, I can.
So, The Innocents, of course, is available on Criterion copies. Like I said at the top of the show, I was unable to secure my copy of it because of misunderstanding.
Because of your own timing skills.
But it's got making of stuff. It's got commentary tracks. It's a beautiful 4K restoration. If you can get your hands on it, I recommend getting the restored edition because the picture is crisp and you want to see this thing as crisp and clear as possible because it's gorge.
One day we should do a live one of these shows.
Where?
I don't know. Somewhere in the street.
Just invite people to watch us talk.
Yeah. I mean, because like you, I feel like you really miss like out on like some of it if you don't see me dabbing or you making your weird facial expressions.
One day, scratching my back in a funny way.
That's you what literally you looked like you were doing this.
It's my little janky dance.
Like that terrible dance you were doing earlier?
What? No, that was a good dance. I was dancing to an Ed Sheeran song, but not like to an Ed Sheeran song that was playing, to an Ed Sheeran song that I was singing. And I was doing this like little finger snap dance. Snapping my fingers and twirling my arms. I can't describe it. It doesn't make any sense if I just describe it.
We need a YouTube channel for all of the movements we just describe.
All of the movements I just describe. Ollie, what is our next movie on our Guillermo del Toro, The Ecstasy of Influence? I'll give you a hint. Oh, behave. Groovy, baby. Yeah. Wait,
is it Burn Witch Burn?
It's Burn Witch Burn, starring Austin Powers himself. Other guy.
I was so confused. I was like, we're not watching Austin Powers for me.
So this is 1962's Burn Witch Burn, also known as...
The one movie that guy is in.
Also known as... But you said the other title, the actual title of it.
Yeah, because I was reading it off Wikipedia.
It was called The Night of the...
Cow?
Cow, cow.
Crow?
Ah.
Raven?
Yeah.
Bird?
Hoo, hoo.
Owl?
Eagle. I don't know how to make an eagle
sound.
That
was a terrible eagle impression.
I don't know how to make an eagle sound. Sydney Hayes... Night of the Eagle, starring Peter Wingard, Janet Blair, Margaret Johnson. That's our next one. I think it may have something to do with a witch or an eagle. I don't know. Burn Witch Burn and Night of the Eagle are two very different.
I think it's only called Burn Witch Burn in America.
No, I think yes. I think you're right. I think you're very
maybe
right.
Maybe because they didn't want to tie our national bird to anything, any movie that was...
Witchy?
Yeah.
Peter Wingard.
That's a great name. He sounds like a wizard.
He's only in... 10 movies, but the picture of him
is awful.
Is just amazing. He looks like a man I would want to know.
Does he?
His real name is Cyril Goldbert.
That's also a wizard name.
Cyril, he does look like a, you know what he looks like? He looks like In the 1970s, there was a movie, a TV movie of Doctor Strange. And this is what he looked like. He looked like this, medallion and all, hairy chest and all.
He looks like a really old Sirius Black.
He does look like a really old Sirius Black. He looks like the best man, is all I'm saying. Yeah, so that's next week. We'll be talking all about Peter Wingard. Oh, behave, behave.
We're not talking about Austin Powers.
We're not going to watch Austin Powers. But, he's also in Flash Gordon.
Okay, we get it. He's in a lot of movies.
Well, join us next week for Night of the Eagle / Burn Witch Burn. And until then, I'm Phil.
And I'm Molly.
And we'll see you when
it's Del Toro time.
Oh, behave.